The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello again, everyone, and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show after a long weekend for our listeners in America and also here in the UK, where we had a bank holiday Monday yesterday. Of course, in the US, it was Memorial Day, as I mentioned on yesterday's program, our special Memorial Day program, where we didn't talk much about Memorial Day. I actually had a short segment that I was going to speak on at the end of yesterday's show, just didn't have the time for it. And as it turns out, I'm glad that I just sort of put it on the shelf for today, because in doing a little extra reading this morning, I think the second segment will be something that you'll enjoy, something that's very uplifting, and that does remember the many sacrifices made for Americans. So it might come a day late, but it's still some good history, some good things to be reminded of. Speaking of history, my son, together with the other juniors and seniors at Imperial Academy, they're currently on their end of the school year trip in Washington, D.C., seeing all kinds of sights. My son's now seen more sights in D.C. than I have, so that makes me very jealous. But last week he was at Arlington Cemetery, and we'll look at some of the history surrounding that cemetery and the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, and then a recent book that came out about the old guard that looks after the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. And to lead off that second segment, I'd also like to just play this incredible national anthem. Played on harmonica by a 96-year-old World War II veteran. This happened on Sunday. It, I think, went around the internet to some degree. So we'll play that in its entirety as well. If you have the chance to view this broadcast on the YouTube live stream, you'll be able to see some pretty cool footage, I think, together with today's radio broadcast. So if you want to see some of it, you can switch over to the YouTube stream that's going on right now. If not, you'll still get a lot out of it just by listening. Well, there was a lot of political news over the three-day weekend, and if there's one thing that we can take away from it, to quote what one commentator said, it's that we've got to prepare for uncertain times. You're really seeing in these European elections and elsewhere. I talked about Theresa May's resignation on yesterday's show. But everywhere that you look, you see it in the United States too. Political chaos, political division, so much hatred and strife. To look at these European elections here in the UK, Britain's Conservative Party. This is the party that's spent more time leading the government over the past century than any other party, and it pulled in just 9% of the vote in the EU elections. Now, again, this is the EU, but still, for the Conservative Party to come in fifth place, Daniel Hannan, he's one of the party's three surviving MEPs, and he called it the worst defeat they've had, the Conservative Party. This is from ITV's political editor, Robert Peston. He said, I never thought I would live to see the Conservative and Unionist Party, dominator of British politics for centuries, falling to a vote share of 9% in a national election. It's pretty amazing. A lot of this support, or the support that would usually be there for the Conservative Party, it went to the Brexit Party, and that party was established 6 weeks ago, just 6 weeks ago, and it went on to win the elections, the EU elections over the weekend, 32% of the vote for Farage's Brexit Party. On yesterday's show, I referred to the, as I say, that resignation announcement from Theresa May on Friday. And so with what happened around this same time, her resignation and then the EU elections, we're almost certainly going to see a pro-Brexit leader rising to the top here in the UK. And that, of course, is significant because of all the things Mr. Armstrong said regarding Brexit. The things he was saying decades ago. I mentioned some of that yesterday at the top of the show. This Peston at ITV, he said, if Boris Johnson looked a shoe-in before last night's results, he's been promoted to whatever is more shoe than that. So he's one of the front runners. And as I say, the other front runners are most likely going to be very much pro-Brexit because that's what the British people want. So you have this devastating blow for the Conservative Party, and then you think that, well, if they did poorly, then the Labour Party certainly is going to perform well. But that's not how it happened. Here again, for Labour, the other prominent party here in the UK, it was an embarrassing defeat, just 14% of the vote. And many on the left, they withdrew their support for Labour and instead got behind even more left-wing parties. And that's been the trend. That's been the trend all across Europe. That's been the trend worldwide. The more radical, the more extreme, the more popular. The Green Party had one of its best ever results. Just behind Labour, 11%. For the Green Party. So what this means, just looking at the weekend that was, is that you have a large majority of people in the UK who are just completely fed up with both of the mainstream parties, the major parties, the Conservative Party and then the Labour Party. The people have spoken. We're tired of the status quo. We're tired of the mainstream parties. Now, as I say, this is the trend continent-wide, and you can see it in these European parliamentary elections. Again, you're seeing the rise of these fringe parties, far-right parties, and the rise of far-left green parties. And then the ones, the center-right and the center-left, those that are more in the middle, they're not performing so well. So these two, the bigger ones, the more mainstream ones that would typically form the coalitions, it's harder for them to come together with these parties on the far right and the far left gaining in popularity. You break it down further into a nation-by-nation look. Well, I mentioned the Britain, but you see this trend on the individual level as well. In France, the far-right party, Marine Le Pen's, national rally, this is the formerly the National Front, it ended up being the biggest party in the EU, just barely beating out French President Emmanuel Macron's party. This is from European Council of Foreign Relations reps. It says, although the two ended up with less than a one-point difference, it was close, in other words, the extreme right's victory is bad news for the French president, as Le Pen made the election a referendum about Macron in an attempt to surf the yellow vest waves. You've seen all of that in the news in recent months. The yellow vest protests, so much discontent on the streets. There's so much unhappiness. The people, they don't want the mainstream parties anymore. In Italy, the far right won by a landslide. Matteo Salvini's League Party took in 34% of the vote. That's a massive boost for that party. And their coalition partner, the Five Star Movement, took in 17%. That's a big lift for that far left party as well. Eastern Europe, they already have pretty much right-wing governments, and they performed well in the EU elections. In Germany and Austria, more surprising developments there. The election plunged Germany's ruling coalition into a crisis where there's more and more pressure now on Angela Merkel. And many commentators saying she might be pushed out. The coalition held a crisis meeting yesterday. They've got to figure out what to do. And here again, in these nations, the far left and the far right, they do pretty well. They're performing at a high level. The AfD party, it got just 11%. But there were certain sections of Germany where the percentage was much higher, particularly in eastern Germany. So you combine all of this. The local summarized the election results saying this. Voters handed Chancellor Angela Merkel's CDU party and its center-left coalition partner SPD their worst score in European election history while doubling support for the Greens amid rising fears over global warming. So the pressure is on Ms. Merkel now. Is she going to get out earlier? Spiegel said this. This instability can lead to a breakup at any time. The CDU and SPD are deeply insecure parties. If, for example, SPD leader Nails were to fall, the question of continued existence of the coalition would immediately arise. So that's in Germany. And then you have Austria. Austria, that Sebastian Kurz, his party didn't do that bad. But then coming out of all of this, there was another scandal that took him out. Here's Sebastian Kurz. His coalition, there was this scandal leading up to it. I guess his coalition is joined with the FBO, the Freedom Party of Austria. And over the last few weeks, there was this video that that surfaced showing the FBO leaders willing to sell these lucrative government contracts to anyone that would make donations to their party, very similar to what the Clinton set up with the Clinton Foundation. Pay to play. And so after this video surfaced, Sebastian Kurz, he canceled the coalition and then sacked the FBO's ministers and called for fresh elections. And then I guess in the interim, he planned to stay on as sort of the caretaker prime minister until they could have another election. But his when he canceled the coalition, his left-wing opponent decided he wanted to humiliate Kurz. And so because he no longer had a majority, he pushed through this vote of no confidence yesterday, and now Kurz is out of office. Now, there's going to be an election here in a couple of months, so he could be right back in there. But going back to what I said at the top, quoting from this commentator from the University of Salzburg, it says, prepare for uncertain times. The post-war era of stability is over. Prepare for uncertainty. You see the rise all across Europe of these fringe extreme parties. And Kurz, speaking of Sebastian Kurz, he was one of the first, I guess, more mainstream leaders to work with these fringe parties. Now he's out, could be back in. But look at what's happening in this world. Look at how many nations, how many people are discontented and upset. My father wrote an article in January, a Trumpet article, talking about these times of uncertainty. He says this is crucial, a crucial historic time for the continent. Its migrant crisis and financial troubles threaten to explode. Radical Islam is now deeply entrenched and could launch further attacks at any moment. And now there's no strong leader at the helm. Can you see why we need to watch Germany? He says Germany's political crisis is sure to get worse. Significant segments of the German people now support extreme political parties. It's just like what we saw over the weekend. Eventually, the significance of this is eventually a strong leader is going to show up that everyone can rally around. Everyone in Germany and, of course, all across Europe, or at least with respect to 10 nations. It says the Germans today hunger for someone different, someone with charisma and vision, someone who can really calm their fears and address the urgent problems facing Germany and Europe. They're hungry. They're hungry all across Europe for strong leadership that can bring a divided electorate together. Well, you know what your Bible prophesies regarding the King of the North in Daniel 11 and verse 40. And then the king that heads up rather that 10 nation conglomerate, Daniel 8, verses 23 and 24. He's also prophesied in Daniel 11 and verse 21. He's going to come in by flatteries. A strong man of fierce countenance to lead Europe through these uncertain times. That's Europe. I just want to draw your attention to one more story before we break. This one coming in from Jerusalem. Brent sent me a piece from Arab News talking about Iran's uncertain future in Syria. And of course, this is important because, as we've said over and over again, eventually Iranian influence in Syria will wane. This article says, these questions arise at a time when the clerical regime in Tehran has reached its lowest point in modern times, and Syria's status as one of the most important arenas for regional conflict is still growing. Further on, it says, considering these factors during an extremely confused and ambiguous stage in the Tehran regime's regional activities, we find that Iran is facing an economic situation far worse than expected. So the sanctions that have been reimposed, they're having an impact. And this may bring about an Iranian retreat, at least from Syria. Now, we've seen Iran's influence spread across the region over the past 7, 8, 9 years. In Syria, it seems as if it's starting to go in the other direction, setting things up for the Psalm 83 alliance. The article says, in addition to the Trump administration's success in targeting the regime's supply lines for its activities in Syria, Iran is also experiencing another terrible dilemma. While the Iranian-Russian alliance enabled the Assad regime to maintain power, tensions have begun to grow in Syria between Russia and Iran, with their positions diverging. So they're beginning to buck heads, these two. And then President Trump is tightening the screws on the mullahs with the sanctions. Let me just give you the conclusion to this article. Again, this is from ArabNews.com. It says, all these factors show that the U.S. strategy of maximum pressure is paying off, and Iran's regime is going through a critical phase in Syria. There are a number of possible scenarios for its militias there. Either they will continue operating without submitting to the overt Israeli-U.S. demands and to the tacit Russian demands that they leave, or if there's some shift in the seriousness of the U.S. administration's strategy in besieging Iran, which is possible given the recent U.S. escalation against Tehran, the regime will be prompted to at least suspend its militias as a prelude to ceasing its expansionist activities in Syria in the short run. So Russia, and then the new presidency in Washington, it's hurting Iran's power in Syria. And it's going to lead to their retreat, at least from that nation. Now, this article talks about how it might be a temporary thing, but as we know from Psalm 83, it's going to be a permanent departure. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send comments to td@kpcg.fm. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Revelation 6 stands out as an important chapter because of how it locks in with another one of Jesus Christ's prophecies. The glorified Christ revealed these future events to John in Revelation 6, and it was Jesus Christ as a human being, God in the flesh, who prophesied these same events in Matthew 24, the same Christ. In the traditional Christian world, we hear a lot about Christ as our sacrifice, our Savior. But how about Jesus Christ the prophet? That's exactly what he was. His gospel and his whole message revolved around prophecy. So to know Christ, means to know about the prophecies he spoke in Revelation and in Matthew. This free booklet, The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse, shows that what Christ prophesied in Matthew 24 is primarily for the end time. For more than five decades, Herbert W. Armstrong declared a powerful and consistent warning about the dramatic fulfillment of end time prophecy. Using the Bible as his guide, Mr. Armstrong made bold predictions about the course of world events long before they occurred. He was right encapsulates what he boldly proclaimed for more than 50 years. This free booklet will build your faith in the certainty of biblical prophecy. Request He Was Right and The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse. Both booklets are offered free of charge at no cost or obligation to you. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com. This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
As I said at the top of the program, I had a short Memorial Day segment prepared for yesterday's show, but just ran out of time with the other news I was covering throughout the program. But as it turns out, I'm glad that I waited because I was able to add a little bit more to this segment. And it comes a day late, I know, but it's also at a time when we're thinking about anniversaries. Next week, you've got the 75-year anniversary of the landing at Normandy. I have President Reagan's, or an excerpt from his speech that he gave back in the 1980s at the 40-year anniversary of the Normandy landing. So if I have time, I'll play that at the end of this segment. But to begin with, I want to start with this 96-year-old World War II veteran. His name is Pete Dupre, and he played the national anthem on his harmonica. He got up out of his wheelchair on Sunday at, I forget where the stadium was, I think in New Jersey perhaps, and he gets up out of his wheelchair and then proceeds, after he's announced, to play the national anthem. 96-year-old World War II veteran. Here's clip one.
Performing today's Star-Spangled Banner, please welcome 96-year-old World War II veteran, Pete Dupre.
Thank you. Well, that was remarkable. 96-year-old Pete Dupree, World War II veteran, who actually met the players on Omaha Beach in Normandy in January. Carly Lloyd said it was the best thing she'd ever done off field for the US team. There he is. And that really did go down a storm.
I got chills.
Yeah.
Listening to that.
That's from the weekend, the soccer game, the women's soccer game between the United States and Mexico. And I'm not even sure who won that. But in any event, a moving scene there at the beginning with the World War II veteran, Pete Dupree, playing the national anthem on his harmonica. He served as a medic, Mr. Dupree, in the 114th General Hospital Unit in Kidderminster here in England. And I think spent 3 years overseas during World War II. So one of the few who are left, they're dying off, that greatest generation, as some have called it. They're dying off. There's not going to be that many at Normandy for the 75-year anniversary next week. I think just 30 of our veterans, 30 American veterans, that are going to make their way over, World War II veterans, making their way over to Normandy on that 75th anniversary. As I say, my son and his classmates have been touring through some of the sites in Washington, D.C., and they visited one last week that I haven't yet visited myself, the Arlington National Cemetery, right there in the heart of Washington, D.C., and this is from the Arlington Cemetery website. It just gives you some of the history of this cemetery. It says it's comprised of land that once belonged to George Washington Parke Custis, grandson of Martha Washington and step-grandson of George Washington. Custis spent his life commemorating Washington and built Arlington House on the 1,100-acre plantation as a memorial to the first president. In 1857, Custis willed the property to his daughter, Mary Ann Randolph Custis, who in 1831 had married U.S. Army Second Lieutenant Robert E. Lee. And so the Lee family, the famous Robert E. Lee family, lived on that property for about 30 years, up until the start of the Civil War. And then they moved, of course, he joined the South and headed up the Confederate Army. But it was during the Civil War, the website says here, by the third year of the Civil War, the increasing number of fatalities was outpacing the burial capacity of Washington, D.C. cemeteries. And so to meet this demand, 200 acres of Arlington Plantation was set aside as a military cemetery. And, of course, the most famous component of this cemetery is the monument, the tomb of the unknown soldier. This memorial to the dead of World War I, World War II, the Korean War, and the Vietnam War. This from CNN. It says the tomb was completed in 1932 at a cost of $48,000. The tomb has the following words inscribed: "Here rests in honored glory an American soldier known but to God." CNN says the tomb is guarded 24 hours a day, every day of the year, by volunteer members of the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, the Old Guard, in full dress uniform carrying M14 rifles. I didn't know much about, I still haven't read Senator Cotton's book, but I didn't know much about the Old Guard until he started going on his book tour recently. It just came out a couple of weeks ago, I think. But this is Senator Tom Cotton, who wrote Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. Mr. Cotton, as I think most of you know, he served in the Army. He had tours in Afghanistan and Iraq. And then when he came back to the States for one stint, I think in 2007 and 2008, he joined up with this 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment also known as the Old Guard. And that's what his book is about. This is a senator just writing a book that is not political at all, in fact. And from the reviews I looked at this morning, seems like a powerful book that really does put on display a level of sacrifice that we don't often talk about in the United States. Not nearly enough, anyway. Mr. Cotton had an interview with Fox News out at Arlington Cemetery recently, and here he is in this clip talking with a Fox News reporter about this sacred ground, about Arlington National Cemetery, clip two.
Yeah, so we're on Memorial Drive.
Memorial Bridge is that way. That was built to symbolically connect the Lincoln Memorial with the Arlington House up on top of the hill, which is where Robert E. Lee and his wife Mary lived for about 30 years until he joined the Confederacy and the Union Army crossed the Potomac River and occupied this land on May 24th, 1861, and they've held it ever since.
And it became a cemetery after the Civil War. Then, of course, in front of Lee's old home is the eternal flame that burns for JFK.
Visitors to the cemetery will often visit the JFK gravesite. They got to see the Tomb of the Unknown Soldiers and the sentinels who guard that tomb every moment of every day for the last 82 years.
And over your right shoulder is Arlington National Cemetery.
That's where the Old Guard does its work every single day, sometimes more than 20 funerals a day inside these gates.
There he is explaining some of the history with the cemetery. And then speaking of this 3rd Infantry, the Old Guard, the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, also known as the Old Guard, and their responsibility today is to look after the funerals that go on at this cemetery, Arlington National Cemetery, and to guard the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Here's Senator Cotton talking about some of the history of the Old Guard, clip three.
So the Old Guard is literally the Old Guard. It is the oldest active duty regiment in the Army, going back to 1784. And you see here, one of the uniforms is the Revolutionary War musician's uniform. For the first 170 years before the Old Guard came to Arlington in 1948, they were serving on the front lines of almost every war, all the way up to World War II. The story of the Old Guard's history is kind of the story of America as a nation.
The story of America goes all the way back even before the Constitution. This Old Guard, the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, they were on the front lines of every major battle or conflict up until 1948, when they were assigned this sacred ground to look after Arlington National Cemetery. He talks about, you would think, well, this isn't really a front lines assignment anymore. And so anyone could serve in the Old Guard if they're just stationed there at Arlington Cemetery. But Senator Cotton talks about the high standards that the Army has for this particular regiment. This is clip four.
The Old Guard has some of the strictest requirements in the military, height and weight standards. For an officer, you have to be Ranger and airborne qualified. The Army really wants to send its very best to Arlington National Cemetery to honor our fallen heroes and their families, to give them that one perfect, final, indelible image of honor.
This is how the United States honors its dead. As I say, we'd all do well to think about this level of sacrifice. His book, Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. His book is about this Old Guard and their responsibilities. One reviewer talks about how that after 9/11, because they were right there in D.C. when one of those terrorists in that plane hit the Pentagon, the Old Guard of the Army stationed just across the highway at the cemetery. So they were ready to act, to sift through the rubble, to look for dead bodies. Some of them working around the clock. This is at the Washington Free Beacon. It says, after about a week, members of the regiment could not cleanse the stench of decay from their bodies. Can't you do something when my husband comes off of a shift? Some of the soldiers' wives asked their commander. He smells like death. So the commander devised a solution. He gave them all instructions. Do this. When you're done with the day, make sure we gather all the clothes up, send them to the laundromat, or get them dry clean, whatever. And try to clean yourself up before you return home. This was a special assignment they had on U.S. soil after that attack in 2001. The Free Beacon says the advent of the War on Terror was a pivotal moment for the Old Guard, and it brought the ceremonial regiment into the national spotlight. Senator Tom Cotton has collected its history in his first book, Sacred Duty, A Soldier's Tour at Arlington National Cemetery. Cotton served in that regiment for 16 months in 2007 and 2008. And then it gives some of the history here, and you heard some of this on the sound already, but it says, founded in 1784, the Old Guard was created by the Continental Congress under the Articles of Confederation to protect the United States after the Revolutionary War. They served in many foreign and domestic conflicts throughout the nation's early history and gained their nickname in the Mexican War during the Army's triumphant 1847 entrance into Mexico City after besieging the city. The 3rd Infantry had fought particularly well in the siege, and General Winfield Scott granted them the privilege of leading the victory parade. As they entered the city's main plaza, Scott instructed the rest of his troops, "Gentlemen, take off your hats to the Old Guard of the Army." The name stuck. Goes back to 1847. The name, the nickname for this regiment, the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment. It says here, the Old Guard spent much of the next 100 years of its existence deployed to various parts of the American frontier and then abroad in both World Wars. Following the close of World War II, it was deactivated, only to be revitalized in 1948 to serve as the official guardians of Arlington National Cemetery. It says, since then, the Old Guard's primary duty has been the performance of funerals. And as Senator Cotton wrote in his book, and as he's explained on numerous interviews since, they prepare for these funerals. This is a once-in-a-lifetime event for the families of the fallen. It's a sad event. It's an emotional event. A funeral to bury your dead, to bury your son. But they sacrifice their lives for their country, for their nation. It says, the elite members of the Old Guard stand watch in front of the tomb of the unknown soldier, the duty for which the regiment is best known. Although Cotton never served in this capacity, he provides testimony from those who did. Like everything in the Old Guard's kin, standing watch over the unknown soldier is a task that must be performed with great reverence, no matter the circumstances. They take it seriously. 24 hours a day, every minute of every day, they stand guard at the tomb of the unknown soldier. And they perform these duties with great reverence, no matter the circumstances. I mentioned our teenagers that are in Washington, D.C. They have been over the past week. And they visited this cemetery last Thursday and other sites too. I think my son said they were in the Pentagon when there was a tornado warning. A tornado had touched down somewhere near the Pentagon. Just a torrential downpour that day. And well, as it happens, the Thursday before Memorial Day, with the Old Guard, it's known as Flags In on Thursday. That's when they put American flags at every single gravesite in Arlington. These tiny, small American flags right in front of all the tombstones. And of course, last Thursday, as I say, there was a torrential downpour. This is from Fox News a few days ago. It says an old guard soldier who was photographed placing a small American flag at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier during a severe thunderstorm is drawing notice ahead of Memorial Day. This happened last week. The same day our children went through this site, it says, the storm hit Thursday in D.C. as members of the 3rd U.S. Infantry Regiment, better known as the Old Guard, were planting flags at each grave at the cemetery, as they do each year at this time. Well, they draw attention to one soldier in particular, and I'll come to that in a second. I think he's from Indianapolis, because this local TV station in Indianapolis, it has a video embedded. Again, if you're watching the live stream on YouTube, you can see the images together with this music. If not, you'll just have to enjoy the music and imagine this ceremony, this tradition, putting these flags into the ground all over Arlington National Cemetery. This was an Indianapolis TV station, a news station from last week, clip 5. That's embedded into an article at an Indianapolis news site. And it's about this story, these soldiers continuing on with their responsibilities, even in the midst of a thunderstorm, a massive storm, and tornado warnings to go with it. The article says here, during the storm, one of the most extraordinary displays of discipline and dedication to duty ever to be witnessed at Arlington National Cemetery was taking place at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. With only a few watching from cover, a tomb sentinel approached the unknowns with U.S. flags in hand. As thunder shook the ground and rains washed down without abandon, the tomb sentinel pierced through the elements with breathtaking precision. He knelt and placed the flags in honor of the unknowns. For the select few who saw this moment, it was jaw-dropping. Humans have their limits, but the old guard has yet to meet theirs. It says here, a comment to the post, this was put on Facebook, I believe, a comment to the post identified the sentinel as Tyler McKee, according to this Indianapolis station. Thousands of homes in the D.C. area lost power in the storm, which also knocked down a significant number of trees, according to WUSA. Several homes were severely damaged. And through it all, here was Tyler McKee, a sentinel in the old guard, carrying on with his yearly tradition of placing those flags before the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, honoring the dead, honoring those who sacrificed all so that we could enjoy the freedoms that we enjoy today. Senator Cotton talked about this level of sacrifice in another interview with Newsmax, clip 7.
One common phrase I heard from the guardians at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier is that the unknowns didn't just give up their lives, they gave up their identities. We'll never know who they are. And when you think about that kind of sacrifice in the service of our nation, what is it to sacrifice a night's worth of sleep so you can get your shoes shined after a long day in the rain, or so you can repress your uniform after a hot, humid summer day? It pales in comparison to that ultimate sacrifice for our nation. And that striving for perfection, that ethos of excellence, I think is a lesson that all readers will be able to take away from sacred duty. In not many jobs do we have such a solemn responsibility, but in every walk of life, in every job we have, we can all strive for that kind of standard of excellence and always strive to be our very best self.
That's what the U.S. military strives for when they're when they're carrying on with those funerals. Something like 20 or 30 funerals per day on average at Arlington National Cemetery. And Mr. Cotton, in some of his interviews, he talked about one in particular, this Chinook that was shot down, I think 12 people. The funeral was all together there at Arlington Cemetery, all 12 of them. And they rehearsed every little detail of that funeral for weeks leading up to the funeral, because these families were coming for one event, the last event to remember their dead, their family, their children, their fathers who made the ultimate sacrifice. The ultimate sacrifice made for a nation. And so to honor those dead, you see some of the traditions in the U.S. military, particularly with this 3rd Infantry Regiment, also known as the Old Guard. What a wonderful tradition. The flags in on Thursday, the lead up to Memorial Day. Of course, there's a big event there every year. Yesterday, I believe it was Vice President Pence who spoke for 20 minutes or so at the ceremony, and then laid a wreath at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. This is our history. This is our history. This is, think of the people, about a million, is it? In the history of war in the United States, or involving the United States, a million of our own who've sacrificed their lives. We're coming up to the 75-year anniversary of the landing at Normandy. And the conquest, well, it wasn't really a conquest, was it? It was the liberation of Europe, the liberation of France. Due to the shed blood, the sacrifice, the ultimate sacrifice. Americans, Canadians, Britons, and others. And I'll be thinking of Ronald Reagan's speech at the 40-year anniversary of the Normandy landings. This goes way back to 1984, June 6th, 1984. I've played it two or three times before on this program. One of my favorite speeches of his, where he talks about the sacrifice and why these boys did it. Clip 6.
40 summers have passed since the battle that you fought here. You were young the day you took these cliffs. Some of you were hardly more than boys with the deepest joys of life before you. Yet you risked everything here. Why? Why did you do it? Well, what impelled you to put aside the instinct for self-preservation and risk your lives to take these cliffs? What inspired all the men of the armies that met here? We look at you and somehow we know the answer. It was faith and belief. It was loyalty and love. The men of Normandy had faith that what they were doing was right, faith that they fought for all humanity, faith that a just God would grant them mercy on this beachhead or on the next. It was the deep knowledge, and pray God we have not lost it, that there is a profound moral difference between the use of force for liberation and the use of force for conquest. You were here to liberate, not to conquer, and so you and those others did not doubt your cause, and you were right not to doubt. You all knew that some things are worth dying for. One's country is worth dying for, And democracy is worth dying for because it's the most deeply honorable form of government ever devised by man.
That's not that long ago. 1984. Here now we're coming up to the 75-year anniversary. And we'll hear, hopefully, more inspiring speeches next week. It's inspiring history, particularly when you think about the spiritual war that we're in. We in God's church, we can draw a lot of lessons, a lot of inspiring lessons from this history. Hebrews 12, well, of course, you know about Ephesians 6, where it talks about putting on the whole armor of God. And then other passages that talk about resisting against the devil, our adversary, and his demon army. The book of Daniel also speaks of that. I mentioned that in the first segment, that strong man that's coming out of the heart of Europe. Hebrews 12, though, in verse 1, it says, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us." When Paul talks about the great cloud of witnesses, this, of course, is following right after all of these heroes mentioned in Hebrews 11, the 11th chapter, men and women of faith. You back up to verse 13 of chapter 11, and it says, "These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them, and embraced them, and confess that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth." This was their overall attitude. "I'm just a stranger or a pilgrim. I'm here to do a service for others. I'm leaving behind all of the comforts and the familiarities to serve and to sacrifice for God." They all died in faith. How did they die? Verse 36, "Others," it said, had a trial of cruel mockings and scourgings. Yes, moreover, of bonds and imprisonment. They were stoned. They were sawn asunder. That means they were sawn in half. They were tempted, it says, were slain with the sword. They wandered about in sheepskins and goatskins, being destitute, afflicted, tormented, of whom the world was not worthy. They wandered in deserts and in mountains and in dens and caves, caves of the earth. It says, "And these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise." They didn't yet receive the promises, and yet they soldiered on. They died in faith. Verse 40. This is the last verse in chapter 11. It says, "For God wanted them to wait and share the even better rewards that were prepared for us." And so what they did centuries ago, the sacrifices they made centuries ago, thousands of years ago, the work they did in those past ages, it's not complete without us, without what we're doing in this last hour. God is preparing us for marriage to His Son. He's preparing us to receive the promises together with these heroes of ours. So continuing on into verse 1 of chapter 12, To repeat, it says, "Wherefore, seeing we also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses," what should we do with this history? What should we do knowing this level of sacrifice that's been made? What should we do? It says, "Lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us." Lay aside those weights, those sins, and run in the race, or fight in this spiritual warfare. And Christ, of course, as commander-in-chief, he's leading the way. He honors the sacrifice of those who went before us. And he says, you follow in their steps. Follow him right into the kingdom of God. Verse 2, it says, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and is set down at the right hand of the throne of God. Look to Jesus Christ. Look to the commander-in-chief. Look to the head of this church and follow him. He's the author and finisher of our faith. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. If you'd like to email the program, you can send feedback to td@kpcg.fm. You can also submit audio feedback at the TDRS page on the trumpet.com website. Thank you for joining us today, and we'll see you tomorrow.